What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks. And that takes us to 8:08 in the morning here on Law and Disorder. I am your host, Kat Brooks. The official death toll of the Israeli genocide on Gaza rises to 73,098, with 173,571 wounded. We know these numbers are undercounts. Israeli airstrikes and 7 renewed displacement orders covering 37 localities across the South and Nabatea governorates triggered additional displacement between June 12th and 14th. 798 deaths and 11,781 injuries since March 2nd. That's according to the Lebanese Public Health Ministry. As of the April so-called ceasefire, the 2026 illegal Iran war has resulted in thousands of deaths and tens of thousands of injuries, mostly in Iran and Lebanon, but also in Iraq, Israel, Palestine, countries around the Persian Gulf, particularly Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates, and other countries and regions. Casualties in these countries have included a diverse range of nationalities. It's Monday, so this is Palestine Post, where we expose Israel's genocidal assault on Palestine and the region, the complicity of the United States in those genocides, the resistance of the people, and the ripple effects across the globe. Joining us today are my sister in struggle, Zahra Ballou, Executive Director of the Bay Area Office of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE, and Omar Shakir, Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, or DAWN. Omar is succeeding the organization's founding director, Sarah Leah Whitson, who we've had on this show. Prior to joining the human rights group founded by Jamil Khashoggi, Shakir spent nearly a decade as the Israel and Palestine director at Human Rights Watch. Mouthful this morning. Good morning, y'all.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. I normally move to the West Bank later on in coverage, but I actually want to start with the West Bank this morning, where settler violence has been on a steady uptick. United Nations inquiry last month reported that Israeli settler attacks on Palestinian villages and agricultural land had surged since 2023 by 130%. Last week, swarms of settlers attacked homes, water supplies, and electrical grids. Over the weekend, a baby died because Israel refused a medical transfer. My question, and I've asked this of guests prior, but again, usually later on in the show, how do we keep attention on the West Bank when the eyes of the world are diverted to Iran? And I believe Israel is taking advantage of those diverted eyes, that we are distracted, and they are, like the word people are using, and I know you both are familiar with, we are witnessing the Gazification of the West Bank. Who would like to begin?
I can start. Just got to say, I think you're exactly right. In many ways, the West Bank, even from October 7th, has always been the real prize, right? Because while the destruction of Gaza and the ethnic cleansing of the population outside of Gaza has been a fantasy for many in the mainstream Israeli political establishment, the West Bank has always been the kind of coveted project in terms of Israel's project of demographic engineering and domination, right? And so the idea in the early days after October 7th was, how can you create a sufficient storm that would allow? Because unlike Gaza, the West Bank has a more easy exit, right? I mean, people can, I mean, there are challenges, but people can leave to Jordan. So the actual idea of diminishing the Palestinian population, especially in Area C, but throughout the West Bank, is very, very viable. And so the Israeli government learned in the first Trump administration, that doing something as bold as, declarative as annexation risks, raising the ire of the world. Whereas if you keep accelerating at turbo pace the project of de facto annexation and ethnic cleansing and crimes against humanity and war crimes, you can proceed so long as you don't, make this kind of big declaration. And the facts on the ground speak to that reality. Now, when you say, as you did, Kat, that settler violence up 130%, that would be alarming in any scenario, but it's especially alarming when you know that 2025, according to the UN, set the record for any year in terms of settler violence. And the rates that we're talking about have continued to increase since 2023. And what And it's not accidental, right? This isn't just an example of certain communities that are extra violent. It's become a tool of land expropriation and confiscation. You know, I was deported by the Israeli government for my human rights reporting back in 2019, but I did manage to find a way back in for two short visits in 2023 and 24 before I got banned again. But what I can tell you is when I was back on the ground 4 or 5 years later, and this is before even all these record levels of settler violence, there were entire parts of the West Bank. I'm talking about like a maps with names of villages that don't exist. You can find old maps that won't exist. Entire areas that had Palestinian communities living there, which now do not have Palestinian communities living there, because settler violence has succeeded where home demolitions fail. Because what Israel has been doing for decades is demolishing Palestinian homes. They come back and rebuild a lot of the time. But settler violence, when people feel that their children, their families cannot live safely, that their very lives are threatened, that causes families to leave. And that's what's happening across the West Bank. So I think we need to keep the focus there, because that's exactly what I think the dream fantasy is now for Israel's center political apparatus.
Zara.
It's good to see you, Kat. It's always good to see you, Omar. The how. So how do we keep the focus there? It's conversations like this, Kat. It's ongoing storytelling. And I hate to say it, but as people are killed, we need to lift up their names. We need to lift up their names, tell their stories, talk about their families. The easy part is that Israel tells on itself. The settlers have made no discernment between U.S. citizens and non-citizens, journalists and non-journalists, aid workers and others. And so they're are plenty of stories of carnage. We just have to remain committed to telling them. And we're distracted by Iran and Lebanon and FIFA, but all of these things can coexist, right? The fact that Iran continues to insist on the protection of Lebanon as part of its own agreements, I think is a really good reminder for us that it doesn't have to be a trade-off, that it's not Gaza versus the West Bank. It's the West Bank also. And in some ways, we may get more coming out of the West Bank because there are still more cameras on the ground there. And so the how for me is just a insistence that wherever we go, Palestine is top of mind, right? And that it's Gaza and the West Bank. And that when people reduce it to Gaza, we remind them of the West Bank. When people reduce it to Hamas, we remind them of the West Bank. And so it's on us to just continue to tell the stories. And I really hate that they're telling on themselves, but they are. And so whether it's this baby today or this teenager tomorrow or somebody, some village disappeared last week, it's ongoing. And they're not stopping. They do it on camera. Like they do it on camera. Palestinians put cameras in their faces and they'll still continue to do it. The other part of this for me is that we have to leverage the growing, who would think that Palestine would take center stage the way it has, right? Like 10 years ago, right? Like all of us have been in this work longer than 10 years, but even just if you were to go back 10 years, like we couldn't imagine it. Like we couldn't imagine that like the flags at the World Cup, the Artists for Ceasefire pins, right? Even the wave of democratic socialists, right? Winning their seats. And so it's, some of us are burnt out, some of us are tired, but there is this growing wave that we have to take advantage of. And the last thing I'll say is on this wave of democratic socialists winning their seats is not everybody running for office everywhere is a democratic socialist, but every single person can be asked whether or not what is happening in Gaza is a ceasefire, right, is a genocide. They can be asked who they're taking money from. And no, it's not enough to say that we won't take money from AIPAC. Like we need to actually be looking at the donors beyond AIPAC, at the other PACs that have been propped up, and ask about their position on arms to Israel, right? Arms of all sorts. But like, let's use this moment to ask. And what we're seeing is that candidates who are distinguishing themselves from democratic institutions, right-wing institutions are winning, right? In the San Francisco Bay Area, we saw Scott Wiener, the most, right, the most virulent Zionist in the California legislature, crumbling under pressure, right? Like he didn't say it was a genocide and within a few days had to change his position after years of advocating for Israel, years of scorched earth perspective, our policies on civil rights. And I love that it wasn't enough, that people are like, hey, like, yeah, you said the words, but like, show us in action. That man deserves no peace anywhere in our region, and he's not getting it.
Listen, I watched, quick digression, I was on, I loathe that man. I loathe
we all do.
I loathe him. And so I do, I get joy when people come for him. And he went to some bar or restaurant in the Mission and got promptly run up out of there by a Latinx relative. And I just cackled. The only other digression that I'll say is that, and yes, we need to pay attention to the wave of democratic socialists. Not all democratic socialists are necessarily the right candidate, right? It's not about a party. It's about a person. I don't want us to get,
agreed.
Where I'm talking about listeners. I don't want us to get caught up in that. And folks, know I got stuff to say about our local DSAs, but that's not what this show is about. So, Omar, you mentioned that the West Bank, that the borders there are easier for people to leave should they decide that, or not even decide, should they be forced out of their home, which led me to think about, okay, well, what does that mean? So if you cross into Jordan, if you go into other places, what does that mean for the material conditions of the Palestinian families that are being chased out of there?
Yeah, I mean, look, let's start with within the West Bank, because that's a more common path, right? Because the Israeli government clearly wants to empty, that's a decades-long project, Area C of Palestinians, right? So most of what we're seeing take place is in Area C. And in most cases, you're seeing the same Gaza model, right? So maximum land, minimum Palestinians. So you know, we used to say, I think B'Tselem had a stat from a decade ago, the Israeli Human Rights Group of 150, 160 non-contiguous territorial islands, which is the West Bank. Now you're sort of seeing, you know, it used to be that you had a sea of Palestinian communities and islands of settlements, and now it's kind of reversing, where you have a sea of settlements and islands of Palestinians, and those islands now, like the small ones, are getting swallowed, and you know, people are moving to the bigger ones, and then eventually you can imagine how the fact pattern goes, right? Those, you know, you start concentrating the population more and more into those circles, right? And you know what happens in those circles, like in Gaza today, that could be a, you know, that's a, obviously more than a couple year project. So, and of course, Palestinians that are displaced, and I've documented this myself, it's incredibly difficult. I mean, look, in the West Bank, early 2025, you had, 40,000, I think the revised number, 32,000 that stayed displaced from just three refugee camps, Jenin, Tul Karim, Nur Shams. For them, and again, human rights groups have interviewed them, these individuals had nowhere to go when their camps were emptied. So, you know, some that were lucky found homes with relatives or friends. Those who were less lucky, also lucky, but a little bit less lucky, went to shelters or dorms of universities. But everything, schooling, income was incredibly, incredibly difficult, right? And that's the idea, because once people are in these situations, right? And there's no prospect to go back to their home. That's when you start thinking about leaving. Now, for those who make it, to your question, Kat, those who decide to leave to Jordan, obviously that's difficult, right? In the sense of, like, you know, Jordan's very expensive, especially if you have, you know, no ties there, no families, you know, rent, day-to-day life, groceries, you know, but I think people who leave do so not because they're, wanting better opportunities, they're doing because they feel they have no chance to continue their life in Palestine, right? And so, and there's always the prospect of, you know, maybe getting somewhere else, right? But yeah, I mean, that's the idea. I mean, though, you know, in Gaza, the population has been they've persevered. You know, they've stayed. Again, they're, you know, Egypt has, Rafah has been largely sealed by the Israelis, and you have other restrictions in place. And obviously people did leave, more than 100,000 during the first 9 months of the genocide, you know, but those that did leave, right, that went to Egypt, again, human rights groups have interviewed those individuals, very difficult predicament, no legal status, access to education, work is incredibly difficult to come by. Many regretted their choices and wanted to go back, but of course they've not really generally been able to go back to Gaza, right, in the context of the genocide continuing. So unfortunately it's the prospects are pretty bleak.
And I had a conversation with Phyllis Bennis, this is probably like a year ago, because we have been and will continue to spend our Mondays talking about Israel's genocide. On the Egypt side of the border, it's more encampment, right? It's more tents. It's more no resources. It's more inhumanity. Yes, Sarah?
That's my understanding of it. And I think Omar would know better, but I just like it's physically and financially impossible to get out. And the people who do, like, there's still a stratification there, right? Like, who has the resources to get out and leverage assistance, if any, is available, who has family on the other side versus who just barely makes it out. It's like any other migration crisis.
No, I was going to say, I mean, that's Zahar is exactly right. Technically, under the Trump plan, movement in and out of Egypt via Rafah was supposed to be reopened. The Israelis found excuses to delay that, and then they have formally opened it, but it's just a trickle, right? So this includes, again, it's problematic on all aspects because, you know, there are there are 12,000, 14,000 people that are in dire need of healthcare that Israel, that they can't get in Gaza because Israel has systematically decimated the healthcare system in Gaza, right? So, and those people's lives hang in the balance. Many have died because they haven't been able to get them and they're having trouble leaving. You have people who have left Gaza for medical reasons or other reasons that want to go back and aren't able to go back, right? Because it's generally been closed. And yes, within Egypt, there is a segment of the population that has, you know, that lives in, I mean, everybody lives in squalor conditions, but it's become largely urban refugees too. People that, like, you know, sort of make it, you know, are within Cairo or larger Cairo or in other parts of Egypt that are just struggling to get by. You know, because in some ways, yes, having tent-like conditions, you know, it has all sorts of challenges, right? But usually in those contexts, there are at least humanitarian organizations that can provide some degree of baseline humanitarian aid. In a place like Cairo, when you just are part of the community, you can live on the margins and it can create its own set of challenges as well.
I think I know the answer, the grim answer to my question. But if Israel wants Palestinians out of Palestine, why make the Rafah crossing so difficult to get through?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Rafah crossing, I mean, there is a set of, it's a very actually good question, Kat, because I think the original vision was very much that Egypt would facilitate letting people leave. I think Egypt, you know, realized not out of any sense of humanitarian or human rights impulse, unfortunately, but out of pure sense of preservation, that if it facilitated that, it would be fully seen as complicit in the genocide and the ethnic cleansing. So Egypt, again, Egypt and Zahra alluded to this earlier, there were policies in the early months of the genocide where you could pay, in essence, an exit fee to an Egyptian actor tied to the government to leave. When Israel took control of Rafah, that changed. But it's not entirely in Israel's control, obviously. And it's part of making life unlivable in Gaza, right? Is that it's, you know, controlling who goes in, who goes out arbitrarily, right? And so I think in an ideal world, yes, they would open up and let people exit, right? But, you know, they would need a certain set of conditions from other countries which haven't been met. And so this suits there because in many ways that option can always still be there, right? You know, it's the people population who lives, if you pull Gaza today, unfortunately, I would guess many, not the overwhelming majority, would say we would leave, because if you can't feed your family, if your kids can't go to school, you know, if there's no prospect. I mean, Netanyahu this weekend said no reconstruction in Gaza until Hamas disarms, which obviously is his way of saying, you know, never reconstruction. So, you know, people are losing hope, obviously, on the ground. So that option can always exist, and you can always create an event that creates a mass exodus. But right now they keep people living on the brink of death.
I'm also curious, like, I've thought a lot also about, like, what is Egypt's concern in terms of its own population shift, right? So if it lets people in, what does that do to the power dynamics in Egypt, where people are also living just struggling? People are struggling. You have a dictatorship in place, you have military control, and all of a sudden there's a surge of Palestinians. So there's a concern about the complicity and the genocide, but there's also a what does this mean for what little is left of our economy, what is set up in our power structures, right? What happens if various movements align? And so Egypt is not cooperating, but not out of any concern for humanitarian perspective, law, or anything. It's just it's self-preservation. You're muted, Kat.
Thank you, Zara. In our last few minutes, I want to bring us to soil here, which is absolutely impacting soil there. The 10-year MOU between the United States and Israel, which grants Israel $30 billion in military aid, expires 2028. This, in theory, presents an opportunity for organizing, particularly through electoral cycles, correct? I've got part two to the question, but let's answer part one first.
Yes, right. Like there's the groundswell of momentum in support of Palestine, tied to anger with the Trump administration, anger with Democrats, anger with Republicans that we're seeing across the country, right? Doctors, teachers, students, everyone is, hey, the words that come to mind are up in arms, but those are not the right words for this conversation, is up and mobilized, right? And so, and you were right earlier, it's not DSA candidates are not all correct, but there is an upswell of them, right? And what is distinguishing, whether they're DSA or otherwise, even among Republicans, by the way, right? Like who would think that I would think of Marjorie Taylor Greene and Tucker and Candace in a conversation with you, but like, right, like that split, I know, I'm sorry, Kat, that split on the right is key. Like people see it. And we're headed into a midterm election. And so we actually need to like make use of the momentum. We need to like lean into the split, right, in all of the parties and put people in office who are going to say enough is enough. Will we get there in this election, or will it take a few more is the question that perplexes me.
My homie W. Kamel Bell did an Instagram post that said something like, if you all invite Tucker to the barbecue, I'm not your friend no more. It was something like that. I'm paraphrasing.
And he's an example also of someone that I don't believe is in it for the right reasons, right? But no permanent friends or enemies.
That's organizing 101, my G, right? We get to that. I mean, the right gets that. They get that right. We don't like each other and we don't all agree what happens when we complete our purification project, but we agree that we will argue about our differences after we deal with our common enemy. And the left had better get it together and understand that strategy instead of eating each other. Again, not this show. All right, so that we have this opportunity, right, in this moment. What also is happening, which I also look at as an opportunity to mobilize folks, right, is that there's legislation moving that would further enmesh Israeli and U.S. Military powers. I'm just going to read from Al Jazeera. Republicans are trying to bypass the traditional foreign aid and military cooperation process by embedding amendments in large budget bills that have to pass. For example, a section of the National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA, for fiscal year 2027 would establish permanent integration of Israeli technology into U.S. military research procurement and manufacturing. Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas has companion legislation embedded into an intelligence authorization bill, which would require the president to expand U.S.-Israeli intelligence cooperation on a wide array of subjects. Here's the kicker: while restricting presidential authority to pause or limit intelligence sharing, which means, should we get someone besides Vance when Trump finally falls to the ills of eating McDonald's every day, we have something written into legislation that means we can't go backwards. Omar, please.
Yeah, so a couple things, right? I mean, Zahar hit the nail on the head. Things are shifting. I mean, look at the last Senator Sanders' resolution of disapproval on bulldozers. 40 out of 47 Democrats voted in favor of disapproval. So, like, basically you have, and that was every major 2028 presidential candidate. Look at elections. You know, Representative Goldman went on CNN and basically said, I lost because of Israel-Palestine, right? So the shifts are changing. Zahra pointed that out. The other part of this, right, is, you know, Don has a lawsuit, the organization I run, suing the State Department for not enforcing its own already existing law, the Leahy Law, against Israel, right? There is no exception for Israel. That law basically says no weapons to abusive units of armies, right? 113 units around the world have been barred from getting U.S. arms. Never once an Israeli army unit. There is no way you can with a straight face say that's based on application of the law. That lawsuit has survived a motion to dismiss. We should get another ruling later this year. I think the Netanyahu government understands where the currents are going, and this is an effort to get ahead of it, right? They know that getting another 10-year renewal is going to be challenging, despite AIPAC and its significant power, despite the force that can be brought to bear by the Israeli government. So this is an effort to keep the defense relationship, but do it in secret, behind closed doors. And again, and even in this respect, they've misplayed their cards. They thought they could sneak this through, they could get ahead of the curve. But, you know, again, there are some voices, Massey on the Republican side, Ro Khanna on the Democratic side, and others, right, in addition to many, many others that are calling them out. So, but we need to stay vigilant on this. And I think ultimately, the reason we're seeing the shift at the political level is because of grassroots work on Palestine, for many, many years, many probably listeners to this program, that needs to keep up ultimately, because the Israeli government's going to, and its supporters are going to keep trying to find quiet way. They don't want the storm. They don't want to risk losing. So they keep trying these different methods to avoid it. But if we're successful, we can stop it. But it's going to take a lot of work on a grassroots level.
Zahra, lastly, you work with illegally detained Palestinians and others, and just any updates on how Trump's attacks on our people, immigrants in particular, is impacting your work or other cases we need to be aware of right now, any calls to actions from CARE?
Yeah, I've never seen people so scared. Like, people with legal status are afraid to apply for benefits. They're afraid to come to programs, and they have good reason to be afraid. People who are deportable are being sent either back to the countries they, in some cases, escaped from, or third countries, right? And then there are others who are languishing for months and months. We work with detained clients who have been behind bars for 6 months, 10 months, 12 months, some for more than a year, with no hope in sight. And the thing that we're always mindful of is that the people that we represent are just a fraction of the people in detention. Maybe they knew someone who called us, maybe they called at the right time and we had capacity, but there are people who aren't getting help pro bono and they also can't afford to pay for it. My best advice to anyone listening is if you are undocumented or high risk based on a criminal record, and by criminal, I just like an arrest, I don't even mean a conviction these days, talk to an immigration attorney before you go anywhere near a border. I was talking to an international student the other day who said that they went to Arizona to attend a friend's graduation. And I was like, do not go there. Do not go to Florida. Do not go to Texas, but also do not go to the extremities of California. If you're going to fly or drive, go anywhere. Talk to an immigration attorney first. It is, what is it? An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And it's the best thing that we can offer right now, because once you're locked up, it's a lot harder to help.
I'm going to thank you both in just a moment, but I'm going to invite you, if you, I know you're both very busy, but the next thing I'm going to do is play a recording from a young person who's part of the Gaza Surf Club, which might be one of the most, I'm starting to tear up already, one of the most beautiful things I've heard in a long time. So if you want to stick around and listen, you can. If you need to check out, that's all good. Zahra Ballou is the Executive Director of the Bay Area Office of Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, and Omar Shakir is the Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, or DAWN. Thank you both so much for joining me. I look forward to talking to you both again soon. That takes us to 8:36 in the morning here on Law and Disorder. I am your host, Kat Brooks. Folks who listen regularly have heard me talk about surfing. I picked it up last year just before my 50th birthday. Yes, you still can do it, y'all. If someone had put a board in my hand at 12 instead of a drink, my life would have taken an entirely different trajectory. The healing and freeing power of the ocean is indescribable. Now, when I say surf, I mean paddle out, sometimes stand for a couple seconds and fall into the ocean, and I do that on repeat for hours with glee. Point being, I follow surfing on the socials, mostly surfing from colonized nations, because that's what I'm interested in. Black folks, brown folks on boards, right? Reclaiming actually the indigenous roots of surfing. It actually was not a white-born sport. I could get into the whole history of surfing on the continent and surfing in Hawaii, but this is how I found the Gaza Surf Club. So next we're going to hear from Abdullah Abu Ghanem of the Gaza Surf Club, who took time to record a message for us directly from Gaza just after a bombing had occurred nearby. Let's roll that tape.
Hello, my name is Abdullah Jawad Abu Ghanem, and I am calling from Gaza. I am a member of the Gaza Surf Club. Thank you for having me on your show, Katie Brooks and team. We know that you and KPFA care about us in Gaza. I am recording this message directly for you because our internet and phone service is not stable enough for a live call. Kat and the team sent over some questions, and I want to answer them for you today. The first question was, why do I surf, and what is my favorite thing about surfing? To me, surfing and getting into the water means surfing is my escape when I am on wave. I forget the war, the fire, and all the breezes around me. The ocean is the only palace where I truly feel free, calm, and alive. They also asked about how we actually manage to surf right now. For me personally, is it far to get the water? Gear is very hard to find. I do have my one surfboard as a club. We only have 7 surfboard in total. We are currently sharing gear that is over 8 years old because surf wax is impossible to import right now. We have to get creative and make our own out of solid materials and fire wax. Getting to the beach is the own challenge. I live far from other people who surf right now. Is unsafe to travel to the water and to surf. I also want to tell the KPFA listeners a bit more about why we surf and how we do it. We surf because the ocean gives us hope, even with very limited equipment. Before I finish, I want to talk a moment to honor and remember my family and friends, both those who are alive and those who are no longer with us. If you want to learn more about me, personal story, you can visit my Instagram account, Abdullah Abu Ghanem, and visit the link in the bio. If you want to learn more about our community, please visit the Gaza Surf Club website at gazasurfclub.com. or check out our official Instagram page, Gaza Surf Club Official. Thank you, KPFA listeners. Thank you, Law and Disorder, and host Kat Brooks. And Kat, before I go, I hear that you serve too. I hope we can talk more about the waves again soon. Thank you so much from in here in Gaza.
That was the voice of Abdullah Abu Ghanem of the Gaza Surf Club. So, yeah, check out them on Instagram and the surfing as resistance and the way in which people are holding on to their humanity and their joy in the face of such savagery. Sorry. I tried to listen to it enough times last night that I thought that once we came on the air this morning, I would be okay, but I cry on the air sometimes. It happens. All right, that takes us to, thank you, Zara. I love you, sister, and we will talk soon. It takes us to 8:42 in the morning here on Law and Disorder. I am your host, Kat Brooks. Verdicts in the Golden Gate 26 case have come in. The Golden Gate 26 are a group of protesters who shut down the Golden Gate Bridge on Tax Day in 2024 to bring attention to the fact that U.S. tax dollars were being utilized for genocide. D.A. Brooke Jenkins has spent the last 2 years trying to throw the book at them. We know that D.A. Brooke Jenkins has spoken out in support of Israel. Historically, about 7 protesters. We're looking at felonies that could have carried upwards of 15 years or more, I think, in prison. Joining us to discuss is Manon Kocher. If I said your name wrong, please correct me. Press correspondent and co-defendant of the Golden Gate 26. None of the 7 or their lawyers are able to speak this time. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Kat. Thank you for having me.
So 7 demonstrators were found guilty on misdemeanor charges. The judge declared a mistrial on the felony conspiracy charge and a misdemeanor trespass to interfere with the business charge because jurors were unable to reach a verdict. Brooke Jenkins is still celebrating all of this and saying, you know, that they were convicted on multiple counts. And she says that all 7 could still face a retrial on 2 unresolved charges, something that I hear surprised the team. And then lastly, I'm getting through some of this because I know we have limited time. The sentencing is still to happen, right? Mm-hmm. So there's still people still may be going to jail, albeit I think what I understand is county jail, not prison.
Mm-hmm.
To put all of what I just said in your own words as someone who also was a defendant, and then concerns, yes, about what precedent is this setting for taking direct action against injustice. If this could happen in San Francisco, which I know is not the San Francisco of before, what is the signal for the rest of the country, especially when we got a fascist in the White House? Well, we got to put our bodies on the line, right? We don't have a choice now.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Kat, for that overview and summary of the case. So my own case, I faced 44 charges, misdemeanor counts, for over 2 years, and my case was resolved via the process of diversion on June 15th of this year. 7 of my fellow co-defendants had to go through the process of trial over the course of 2 months, only to learn a verdict where they were found guilty of multiple misdemeanor counts, including 4 counts of false imprisonment. Now, that is where the precedent that you were speaking of, that is scary for the movement, that is scary for folks that stand up against against fascism, against injustices, really comes in. Being guilty of false imprisonment implies that in the future, if we use tactics of blocking roadways, which has been a tool of the people to draw attention to the emergencies of our times, the government can charge you with false imprisonment of commuters behind you. They can come forward and go onto social media like SFDA Jenkins did 2 years ago and solicit people to come forward as apparent victims of protesters who are asking our government to stop our tax dollars being used to kill children and people across the world. So the precedent set here is extremely dangerous, and the fight is far from over. The fight in this case is far from over, as I hope we appeal these convictions. The fight is far from over as D.A. Jenkins threatens to retry the case on the felony counts, and the fight is far from over from the United States funding and arming this genocide. Oh, you're muted, Kat.
All morning, me and this mute button. What do we do now? So what is the call to action? Because we got to wrap up. What is the call to action in the immediacy?
So the call to action is to support efforts to stop arms transfers to Israel immediately. A local and one that is connected with a lot of different efforts across the country is joining the Oakland Arms Embargo Campaign on armsembargonow.com. The sentencing hearing is coming up on August the 21st. We ask folks to please support us and follow us on GG26 Solidarity on Instagram and follow updates on the case on GoldenGateDefendants.com. those are some immediate ways in which folks can be supportive of us. But yeah, the fight is far from over, Kat. And even though we welcome the fact that the jury didn't convict our co-defendants on the felony conspiracy charge, speaking to some of their conscience, we are sitting in some grief given the recent convictions.
Why do I notice those last question? I think I'm just gonna shorten my announcements this morning. What does Brooke Jenkins get out of persecuting people that stood against genocide?
So Brooke Jenkins, the charging of Brooke Jenkins' office has increased by 60% since 2021. So the prosecution in this case is not isolated, Kat, as you know. The prosecution across San Francisco has been going up, and people in power don't want ordinary people to disrupt their day-to-day lives as they build arms, as they ship them, as they send our money to Israel, maintaining the hegemonic power of the U.S.-Israeli alliance is very much one of the things that is really important to people in power, especially in the Bay Area. So Brooke Jenkins and her office is a tool to prosecute anyone who speaks out against that. She is doing that job. However, one last thing that I would say is that we were charged with 1,144 counts in August of 2024. At the start of this trial, the DA's office was tasked to prove that only 57 of those charges, so the charges dwindled from 1,000 over 1,100 to 57 charges. And she was tasked to prove without a reasonable doubt that those 57 charges, that my fellow protesters were guilty of those 57 charges. She was not able to do that. So the case continues to dwindle and it continues to unfold at great cost to my co-defendants and at a great cost to our community and the people of Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria who are continuing to face this genocide. So we are steadfast in this fight, and I appreciate you bringing us on here to share this story.
Anytime. If we don't reach out to y'all, y'all hit us up when it's time for y'all to come back for the next call to action. You will always have a platform.
We will. Thank you so much.
For appreciate this morning.
Take care.
Manon Kocher is a press correspondent and co-defendant of the Golden Gate 26 who stopped traffic on the Golden Gate Bridge on tax day 2024. None of the seven other lawyers are able to speak out at this time. Okay, just a couple real quick announcements. Today, there is a national call to stand with immigrants' rights activist Nadia Topete, saying no to grand jury repression. On July 1st, law enforcement came to her home to deliver a subpoena ordering her to speak in front of a grand jury. She had first been subpoenaed to testify in June. The committee to stop FBI repression condemns the second subpoena of Topete and are fighting the attempt to jail her. They believe the grand jury is related to the anti-ICE activism in Los Angeles last summer. So it's today from 9 to 5 PST. Call Bilal Asseli, U.S. Attorney Central District Office Line, 714-338-3500. Bilal Asseli, 714-338-3500, press 0. And Assistant U.S. Attorney Michael Wheat, 619-557-5610. Assistant U.S. Attorney Michael Wheat, 619-557-5610. And the script is to say to get rid of that subpoena for Nadia Topete. You can Google more information about the case. Don't forget there's a national boycott of Walmart that has been called by the Building Bridges Coalition following the murder of one-year-old Cohen Cardio Wiley in Senatobia, Mississippi. And Mental Health First is open for your calls regarding mental health, domestic violence, safety planning, and substance overutilization concerns Wednesday through Sunday, 8 p.m. to 12 a.m., 510-999-9641. If you have community events, announcements, PSAs, movement-related things, artist-related things, send them to Law and Disorder at kpfa.org. You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5.
If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.